Well, first I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me for this Quantum Information Program and for the conference. This is the outline of the talk I'm going to give you today. First, I'm going to start with a very quick introduction to decoherence. Then I'll tell you about how to probe decoherence in cavity QED. I'll tell you about quantum state measurement in quantum optics, and also give you a quick introduction to the Wigner distribution and some recent experiments which have measured this distribution. Jeff Kimball has already mentioned the Wigner distribution in his talk. And then I'll have some discussion about what might come next. Now, let me start with some very simple model for a quantum state measurement, which will be useful, however, for our talk, since we are frequently will be coming back to this model along the way. And the idea is the following. We have a measuring apparatus, and we are measuring at, say, a two-level system. So if this two-level system is the upper state, the pointer points towards one direction. If it is in the lower state, the pointer points towards another direction. Now, suppose we prepare this two-level system in an equal weight superposition of the upper and the lower state. So because quantum mechanics is a linear theory, if before the interaction of between the system and the measuring apparatus you have this product state, then after the interaction you have an entangled state. And if you assume, for instance, that this atom which is being measured gets stuck to the detector here, we can actually think of this state here as a superposition of two different states of the measuring apparatus. One which has already one more atom stuck to it. So one is the state in which the pointer points towards this direction, and the other is the state in which the pointer points towards this direction here. Now, so we get with this measurement a coherent superposition of two states of this macroscopic device. And of course, we know that whenever we have this situation, that means that a complementary experiments can be done. We can either look at the apparatus and see that the pointer is pointing towards one direction or the other, like in Young's experiment, when you look at which at the slits and see by which slit and try to see by which slit the photon has gone, or we can make an interference experiment. And the question then is why interference cannot be seen under this situation. And several kinds of answers have been done for this question. People have, for instance, mentioned the existence of superselection rule. In other words, we do not have non-local observables available with matrix elements between the two pointer states. So we cannot detect this interference between them. Even if the coherence is there, we cannot detect it. More recently, the idea of decoherence has played a more important role. Decoherence is related to the entanglement between this apparatus and the environment. And decoherence plays a very important role in the sense that it transforms the coherent superposition of the two pointers into a statistical mixture in a very short time. The more macroscopic is the apparatus, the shorter is this time. And therefore, we can consider that the coherence time is a very important time scale in quantum mechanics. And what I'm going to tell you about today is that cavity QED allows one to actually monitor the decoherence between classically distinct positions of a pointer. And then I'll tell you about some new experimental possibilities which would allow us to investigate more closely this phenomenon. Now, so let me start with a femto introduction to cavity QED. So we have high-Q cavity in which you can trap an electromagnetic field. Experiments on cavity QED have been done in the microwave domain by Haroche and Walter's group, in the optical domain by Kimball and Rempe. Jeff has told you about some extra work which is being done nowadays with trapped ions in cavities. I will concentrate in this talk on the microwave domain, and in this case, these superconducting cavities can hold a photon for times up to 1 second. Actually, that depends very much on the geometry of the cavity. Closed geometries are better for keeping photons inside. Open geometries are worse in this sense. However, they have the advantage that you can have, say, a potential between these two mirrors, and with these potentials, you can control the atoms. So it's a trade-off. It depends on the experiment you want to do. Now, the field manipulation and measurement will be done by sending Rydberg atoms through the cavity. You cannot put a detector in the cavity, that will spoil the cue, so you send an atom. And this atom serves this dual purpose. It prepares the field and it measures the field. And especially for the open cavity arrangement, these atoms are planetary Rydberg atoms. They have a very high principal quantum number of the order of 50. In an angular momentum which is equal to n minus 1, so it's the highest allowed angular momentum. And because these atoms are almost classical, the electron is very far from the nucleus, they have a very high lifetime, which can be understood classically. This electron is slowly accelerated because it's too far away from the nucleus. And you can get actual atoms with a lifetime of the order of 30 milliseconds in this case. Now, we'll be dealing both with resonant interactions between these atoms and electromagnetic fields, and also with dispersive interactions. And it's very easy to understand what happens in a dispersive interaction, just classically. You have some, say, wave in a cavity, and the wavelength is related to the frequency through this relation here. C is the speed of light in the cavity. Now insert into the cavity a transparent material, which means that you have a dispersive interaction between this material and the cavity. Now, because of that, the velocity of light in the cavity will change. Now, the wavelength cannot change because of the boundary condition, so the frequency changes. And therefore, if you inject this slab and then take it off, the overall consequence of that is that you'll have a phase shift induced into the field. Now, the amazing thing nowadays in atomic physics is that with these Rydberg atoms, you know, they have a huge dipole, just a single atom can produce a very important refraction index. And we'll be dealing with the interaction of between single atoms and cavity fields. The idea is that you have, say, a transition between an excited state and a less excited state, even though we call it G, it's not the ground state, not at all, it's a very highly excited state. And transition frequency between these two levels is close to some cavity mode frequency, but it is sufficiently detuned from it so that you don't get a transition between these two states. You just have a dispersive interaction between these two, between this atom and the field. Now, we know from the classical discussion that the consequence of that should be to produce a phase shift in the field, or a frequency shift, which will be transformed into a phase shift. Quantum mechanically, it's very easy to understand that as well. Suppose you have a coherent state in the cavity, and you send the atom, say, in state E. So before the atom interacts with the field, you can write the state of the atom field system as a product state. This is just the expansion of a coherent state in terms of Fock states. After the atom interacts with the field, then a phase shift is induced in the field, which is proportional to the number of photons in the state. Actually, this is nothing more than the Stark shift, the dispersive Stark shift, which is proportional to the number of photons. So now you look at this expression here, and you see that this is nothing more than a phase-shifted coherent state. So that's the way to understand it quantum mechanically. So as this atom interacts with the cavity field, it will produce a phase shift. And now I'm going to show you how you can use this system to measure the coherence in cavity QED. So that's the that's a schematic representation of the setup. You have here an atomic oven which produces an atomic beam. These atoms are excited by a combination of laser and microwave beams to a highly excited Rydberg state, say n equal to 50, and then these atoms go through this cavity here, which is actually a low Q cavity, and they interact resonantly with the field there. So the effect of this field on the atoms is completely analogous to the effect of a magnetic field on a spin 1/2. The atom undergoes in the state space a pi over 2 rotation. The idea is that we send this atom through the system, so it will interact with all these cavities. And as it goes through this cavity here and this one, so it will suffer this pi over 2 rotation here, like a spin 1/2. Then the atom goes through this high Q cavity here, and we can inject fields into this cavity, so the atom interacts with fields which are present in this cavity. Then again it suffers a pi over 2 rotation, and finally one detects the atom. And this is an ionization detector which can tell us if the atom is in the E or the G state. Now, let us follow the atom more closely while it goes through the system. So first, it goes through this cavity here, so you get this pi over 2 transformation. We'll assume that we have initially a coherent state in the cavity, which is injected by this microwave generator. Now, the atom goes through the high Q cavity, this blue cavity here, and it will have a dispersive interaction with the field in such a way that if it is in state E, the field frequency will suffer a displacement. And if it is in state G, there will be also displacement, but in the opposite direction. We're just talking about stark shifts, which are in opposite directions depending on the atomic state. So the atom goes then through this high Q cavity, and you see what happens. You get now the atomic states entangled with field states which have different phases. And if you remember the first slide of my talk, or the second one after the online, you see that this is precisely the state we get in the measuring process. If you consider these coherent states as pointers, this is an entangled state between the two-level system, which is the atom, and this hopefully microscopic pointers, which are the coherent states with different phases. Okay? Now, at this moment, we could detect the atomic state, say, using the ionization detectors, and the result will not be very exciting, because if we detect the atomic state here, you see that if the atom is in state E, we just get the field with this phase here, we project the state onto this state. If we detect the atom in state G, then we project this state of the field onto the other state. Now, you recognize this as an EPR pair between the atom and the field, and precisely as in EPR experiments, we can choose what kind of measurement we do in the atom. So we can rotate it by pi over 2 before measuring the atomic state. And then you see what happens. Now the state alpha e to the I phi is entangled with E and G because of the pi over 2 rotation, and the other phase is entangled with this other combination of E and G. So now if we detect the atomic state, either in the E state or in the G state, we'll get a superposition of two coherent states. So we get a coherent superposition of this pointer, and the state we get is something like that, okay? With some phase between the two states, which depends on whether we detect the atom in the E or in the G state. Okay? So by following this procedure, we are able to produce a coherent superposition of two coherent states, which would be our pointers in this case. Now, of course, the big question now is how to detect this state and how to distinguish it from a statistical mixture. Okay? And of course, we are not allowed to put a detector in the cavity that spoils the Q. So the only thing we can do is to send atoms. And the general idea is that, you know, this state here is usually called the Schrödinger cat-like state, and certainly a misnomer, but, you know, it's just an analogy. And the idea is that if you want to measure the state of a cat in the cavity, of course, the sensible thing to do is to send a mouse, okay? And everybody knows that the mouse is quite sensitive to the state of a cat. So that's the basic idea we are going to follow. In order to detect the coherence, the idea is to send a second atom, and this atom is the mouse, okay, which probes the state of this field. Now, this idea was mentioned already in 1993 and then further elaborated in 1996. This is a collaboration with the French group of Serge Arroche. And what we get then is the following. Suppose the phase difference between the two coherent states is pi, then what one can show is that if you have a coherent superposition of these two coherent states, then the preparation and the probing atoms are always detected in the same state. That means that if you first, in order to create this state, you detected the atom in the E state, then the second atom which is going to probe the field is also going to be detected in the E state. Okay? So there is a 100% correlation between the two measurements, and that's a signature of the coherence of this superposition. On the other hand, if one gets a statistical mixture, then the second atom will be detected in the E or the G state with 50% chance. That means that the system has lost memory of whatever happened before. Okay? So by making a correlation experiment, we can detect whether the system is in a coherent superposition or not. Furthermore, we can delay sending the second atom. And by doing that, we can actually follow the decoherence process in time. Okay? Now, of course, we have dissipation, and in this case, dissipation is actually very welcome because we want to study the effect of dissipation. So, we can show that if we have dissipation, then the behavior of this conditional or this joint probability, say, of getting the first atom in the E state here and the second in the E state, behaves like it is shown here. You see that if you send the second atom right after you produce the field, after the first atom interaction, then you get perfect correlation between the first and the second atom. On the other hand, if you wait some time, you see that this correlation here goes down very quickly to the value 1/2. And then finally, you get just zero for this correlation, which is easy to understand. Say, in this case here, the field has already decayed in the cavity. Okay? So, you know, the first classical region interaction will produce a pi over 2 pulse. Then you have a second pi over 2 pulse. So the net effect is to have a pi pulse, which will take the atom from the E state to the G state. So if there is no field in the cavity, if the field has already leaked, the atom will come out in the G state, and that's what we see here. Now, this time scale here, very fast time scale, so this is in units of gamma tau, so it's in units of the decay time of the field in the cavity. So this very fast the time scale here is given by this expression here. This is the magnitude of the complex number which defines the coherent state. Actually, this is really the number of photons in the cavity. So what this is telling us is that the coherence time is the damping time for the field in the cavity divided by the number of photons, in the average number of photons in the cavity. And that's easy to understand. That's only telling us that it takes just one photon to leave the cavity so that we know whether the state of the field is alpha or minus alpha. Or in other words, during this time, the state, the superposition of alpha and minus alpha gets entangled with orthogonal states of the reservoir. Now, since we are dealing with dispersive interactions between the atom and the field we are probing, that has a big advantage. This is a quantum non-demolition measurement for the photon number. And that means that this procedure is rather insensitive to atomic detection efficiency. We can miss some atoms, and that really doesn't matter. Okay, that doesn't spoil the experiment. Now, what about the experimental results? The experiment was realized by the Ecole-Normal group in 96. And this shows two cases which have been examined by them. Here you have a bigger phase shift for the system, which means that you get a larger separation between the two coherent states. So you expect the coherence time to be smaller. And this shows really the coherence time. These are the experimental points, and this is a theoretical curve. On the other hand, if the two coherent states are closer to each other, you get a slower decay. And the experimental results coincide perfectly with the theoretical calculation. So actually, this is the plot of PE minus PEG. So it's the difference between the two conditional probabilities, so that you get rid of that plateau which shows up. The 1/2 plateau is taken care of by looking at this difference there. And in these experiments, you see that the maximum angle which was obtained was of the order of pi over 4. That means that the angle between the two is a little bit larger than pi over 2. Okay? And the reason for that is that if you want to increase the phase shift, you should slow down the atom. And if you slow down the atom too much, you should increase the Q of the cavity so that the field doesn't leak out before you measure it. So that was a limitation for these experiments, but the situation now is actually better than the situation when these experiments were done. Now, of course, a question which shows up immediately is the following. You see, these experiments were able to probe the decoherence by following the behavior of this conditional probability. Now, it's quite sure that this gives me partial information on the field. Of course, if I just send one atom to probe the field, it's quite clear that that's not going to give me complete information on the field. It's a quite partial information. And the question which was raised right after this experiment, or as this experiment was being planned, was, can we get a more complete information on the field? What kind of information are we really getting on the state by performing this experiment? And can we go beyond that? Okay. So in order to analyze this problem, I'll have to just make a quick introduction to phase space representations. And we will be looking for a representation, a quantum mechanical representation, which is as close as possible to a classical representation. That means that we will require that the marginal distributions coincide with the probability distribution, say, for the momentum and the position of a particle. That's considering just one particle in one dimension. So this distribution should satisfy these properties here. And actually, we could generalize this immediately by saying that these properties should remain true if the axes are rotated. So the more general property which we would like our distribution to satisfy is this one. If we integrate this distribution over any direction in phase space, we should get the probability distribution for the orthogonal variable. So, and also, quantum mechanics will tell us that this probability distribution should be given by this expression in terms of the density matrix, where U of theta is a rotation operator applied to the Q eigenstate. Okay? So that's what quantum mechanics tells us. So in fact, in this equation here, we have two equations. One of them is just a classical one, doesn't have anything to do with quantum mechanics. Okay? And the second part is where quantum mechanics comes in. Okay? It relates this marginal distribution to the density operator. Now, let's examine for a moment the first part of this equation. You see that this is really an integral transform because I start from a function which is a function of Q and P, and I end up with a function of Q and theta. So it's an integral transform. And it turns out that this integral transform can be inverted. In fact, one can show that P of Q theta, the ensemble of marginal distributions, determines uniquely this distribution. And the inverse transformation is called Radom inverse transform. It was discovered in 1917 by Johann Radom. And you know that because that's the principle of tomography. Okay? So that tomography goes along the same lines precisely. You send some field around, through some object, and you measure the absorption here. And the absorption is an integrated quantity. So you measure the absorption over all directions. With that, you can reconstruct the spatial variation of the absorption in this material. So in fact, for finding out about that, Cormack and Hounsfield got the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1979. Now it took some time for the physics community to figure out that it could be applied actually to measure quantum states. And the first remark in that along that direction was made by Bertrand and Bertrand in an article published in Foundations of Physics in 1987. So they showed, in fact, that the function one gets from P of Q theta using the second half of the equation I showed you is precisely the Wigner distribution. which was introduced in 1932 by Wigner, in order to calculate quantum corrections to classical statistical mechanics. So that's the definition which was written down by Wigner. X here is an eigenstate of the position operator, again considering a particle in one dimension. And in 1949, Moyal actually showed that this function can be used to calculate averages of operators in symmetric form. That means if you want to calculate this average here, you can replace X and P by C numbers and then calculate the average of XP as if it was a classical function using this Wigner distribution. Now, you realize that this is a Fourier transform relation, which means that you can get the density matrix in terms of the Wigner function easily. So it's completely equivalent in principle to give to know the Wigner function of a system or to know the density matrix of a system. Now, let me give some examples of Wigner functions. This is the Wigner function for the ground state of a harmonic oscillator. This is the Wigner function for a Fock state of the harmonic oscillator, an eigenstate with n equal to 3. And you see the negative value showing up here, which shows that this state cannot be described in classical terms, okay, by a positive definite distribution in phase space. This is the Wigner distribution for a mixture of two coherent states. You have just two Gaussians here, each one corresponding to each of the contributions to this mixture. And finally, this is the Wigner function for a coherent superposition of two coherent states. And you see the difference between this Wigner function and this one. The difference arises from this interference fringes around the origin of phase space. And this is actually the signature of the coherence of this superposition. Okay. Now, a very beautiful demonstration, experimental demonstration of a negative Wigner function was done by Wineland's group, who measured the Wigner function of the motional state of an ion in a trap. They put it in the n equal to 1 state of a harmonic trap. And therefore, they get this Wigner function, which exhibits a negative value. And from it, they can get a density matrix, which shows that you really have the n equal to 1 state populated, some noise in other states. Now, so from all that, of course, you see that it would be extremely nice if you could measure the Wigner function of a field in a cavity. In fact, that would be a much more complete measurement than the one made so far, because you would be able to see this coherent superposition of two coherent states going into a statistical mixture and then finally leaking out of the cavity and getting transformed into just the Gaussian corresponding to the ground state. So that's what we would like to do, to follow, say, the coherent superposition of coherent states. Now, and if we could do that, then you'd see that the fringes would first disappear, and then you'll see the two Gaussians. You know, first you get the statistical mixture showing up, and then the two Gaussians will get transformed into this ground state, the vacuum state Gaussian. Now, in order to do that, we have to apply these concepts to measuring the electromagnetic field in phase space. In fact, the analogy is complete. Jeff has already talked about this in his talk. So if you have a monomode electromagnetic field, you can write it in terms of cosine and sine components, as it is shown there. And these amplitudes of the cosine and sine components are called quadratures of the field. They are analog to the initial position and momentum of a harmonic oscillator. You see that these two equations here really correspond to each other. So for an electromagnetic field, we would like to measure something like a distribution, probability distribution of the quadratures Q1 and Q2. And it was mentioned by Risken and Fogel in 1989 that we can actually do that, because we know how to measure quadratures in optics using the technique of homodyne measurements. So by measuring the probability distribution of these quadratures, we can actually measure the Wigner function for an experimental, for an electromagnetic field. And experiments on that were done first in 1993, showing the Wigner function for a squeeze in a vacuum state. Wonderful experimental results were obtained by Mlinek's group, showing the Wigner function of squeezed states. And if you look at this functions, you immediately see that they are all positive. And in fact, they are all Gaussian. So we thought that it would be very nice to measure a Wigner function with a negative value for an electromagnetic field. And this was actually done last year But in a very particular case, what was measured there was the Wigner function, the value of the Wigner function at the origin of phase space for one photon field in a cavity. And it was shown that this value is negative. Okay? So that was a partial measurement. Of course, it would be much nicer to make a complete measurement of the Wigner function. And this was done by Mlinek's group. I'm not going to go into the detail of that because of time, but you know, it was a clever experiment in which they used a twin photon generator and used one of the photons as a trigger in order to be sure that you had just one photon in the other branch. So with that, they could measure a Wigner function, which showed some negative value, still with a very low contrast. Now, in 97, together with a PhD student, we proposed a method for directly measuring the Wigner distribution for an electromagnetic field in a cavity. And this proposal was actually based on the following expression for the Wigner function, which showed up in a paper by Cahill and Glauber in 1969. Now, this is a very compact expression, which expresses the Wigner function in terms of the average of, say, of this operator here, in terms of displaced density operator. So these are the displacement operators. And this is just the parity operator. You see that if you sandwich the annihilation operator between this P here, you get minus A, so it's a parity operator. And you can show that the Wigner function can be written in this way with a normalization such that the magnitude of it is smaller or equal to 2. Now again, the fact that you can use it to calculate symmetrical averages of operator or averages of symmetrical operators remains true in this notation. And so let me go quickly on that. So the displacement operator is translates position and momentum in phase space, and it can actually be produced in quantum optics by connecting a microwave generator to the cavity where you want to displace the field, because the microwave generator is like a classical current. And if you look at this expression here, this is like the evolution operator for a harmonic oscillator in the presence of a classical force or of a field in the cavity interacting with a classical current. So that's the idea. And you see that if you look at that expression proposed by Cahill and Glauber, you see that there are two operators which show up there. The displacement operator, which we know how to do. We just connect the microwave generator to the cavity. And the parity operator, which you also know how to do. You see, it's an operator which is an exponential proportion to the number of photons, but that's precisely like the dispersive phase shift we had in this cavity QED experiments. So the proposal is the following. First, you displace the field to be measured. That is, you turn on the microwave. You start with some field in the cavity, and then you want to measure it. So you displace the field to be measured. Then you send an atom, and you displace the phase of the field by pi using the same approach I mentioned to you before. Okay, the atom is in a superposition of E and G. Then you detect the atomic state. Then you produce field anew, and you repeat procedure since you need a statistical experiment, of course. Yeah. Now, if you do that many times, you finally find the following result that was shown with this student of mine, that the difference between the probability of finding the atom in the E state minus the probability of finding the atom in the G state is precisely equal to the Wigner function evaluated at the point minus alpha conjugate of phase space. Okay? So, this is a procedure for actually directly measuring the Wigner function, directly in the sense that you don't need integral transforms. Okay? Also note that by doing that, we measure the Wigner function. Once you prepare the state, you measure it by sending just one atom through the cavity, okay? Which means that you really get a snapshot of the state. That's especially useful if the state evolves with time, and more useful if the state evolves quickly with time, so you need to measure it fast. Okay? Now, this is the way which was, you know, this is the experiment which I mentioned to you, which was held in Paris, was related to this idea. A two-level atom was sent through a cavity, but with one caveat. You know, I told you that a pi phase shift was difficult to get in cavity QED experiments because you need a long interaction time. But if you are interested in just measuring a one photon field at the original phase space, you don't have to displace the field. Okay? And if you have a one-photon field, you can replace the dispersive interaction by a 2-pi rotation, which also changes the phase of the system because of this property of spins. You know, if you have a 2-pi rotation, the sign changes. So you send this atom, and if the atom is in state G, say you have a 2-pi rotation, so you have a change of sign. If the atom is in state I, say, there is no sign change. So this allows us to measure the negative value of the Wigner function at the original phase space for a one-photon field. This is also phase gate. So you see that building up a phase gate or measuring the Wigner function at the original phase space are the same experiment, really. And these are the experimental results for a vacuum state field. And for one photon field, you see that we don't get the maximum bound here too, because of noise and several experimental problems. But it's the error we can show is enough to distinguish between these two values and to establish the negative value of the Wigner function. Now, what comes next? One possibility is to have experiments with two cavities. Okay? So you send an atom through these two cavities, and with this configuration, with a pi rotation of the atomic state between the two cavities, it's easy to show that you get an entangled state between two coherent states of this sort. Okay? And if you see that if you have this kind of state, and if you now displace by alpha the state of the field in one of the cavities, then you immediately get this state here. Okay? Which is a funny state of the field. It tells us that, you know, you have two cavities. One of them is lighted, the other is dark, but you don't know which one. And you have a coherent superposition of the two possibilities. Now, why is this interesting? Well, first, you see, this is really a realization of this quantum measurement problem, now with spatially localized pointers. Okay? You have two pointers, which are left point leftwards or rightwards, depending on the state of the atom you are measuring. Okay? So this is a more realistic, say, realization of this measuring model, which we can do. Second, you can also think of this as an interference experiment, like Young's interference experiment. You see that you have a coherent state, which can be either here or here. Now, this is like a two-slit experiment. This is one slit. This is the other slit. Except that instead of having one photon in each slit, you have a coherent state in either one slit or the other. So you have a kind of photon molecule with many photons, which can go coherently through one slit or the other. And this will, of course, produce interference fringes, which reflect the size of this molecule. And in a Young's experiment, we can probe these coherence fringes by sending the field through the screen. Here we cannot do that. However, we can take the screen to the slits by sending an atom through the two cavities, and its atom measures these fields and will show up these interference fringes. Third, these cavities, this system can be used for teleportation, for demonstration of teleportation. This proposal was presented in 1994. You send an atom through the first cavity and reproduce its state on an atom which is sent through the second cavity. And finally, this system can be used for demonstration of distillation. And this is the last slide before I'm beaten up by the chairman. Okay? So the idea is the following. You have these two cavities, and by sending an atom through these two cavities, and actually, I mean, that's the situation now, you can have two molds in each cavity. They are neighbor molds. So by sending atoms through this, two atoms actually, you can produce two pairs of entangled molds, in which one photon is in one cavity or the other. And of course, as time goes on, this state is going to decay, and you are going to get a mixed state. And what one can show is that we can follow, in this case, a variation of the BBPSSW protocol from 96. Okay? And in fact, it's a nice variation, because we can show that by sending, this is the fidelity in this case, by sending two atoms, one through each cavity, we can completely purify the state, just one step. In just one step, we reduce the state to the initial state if the two atoms are detected in state E. Okay, so we recover the initial state with just one purification step. Now, another application, another possible application, if you have four coherent states, you get this chessboard structure in phase space. Okay? Now, of course, we know how to do it in cavity QED. With the first atom, we produce a superposition of two coherent states, and then we send a second atom, which splits each of these two coherent states into two other coherent states. So we get a four coherent states superposition, and we can measure the Wigner function of that directly, as I told you. So we can actually have direct access to this checkerboard structure, which is very easy to attain, supplanck structures, in other words, details in cells which are with areas smaller than h bar squared. Okay. So finally, some further questions, theoretical questions, which might be interesting to address. It would be interesting to actually calculate a complete decoherence theory for this system. In other words, this reminds us of the Josephson junction structure, because this field in the cavity, the different coherent states are associated with different currents in the mirrors. So do we have a coherent superposition of currents in the mirrors? And this calculation is actually a nice one. Measuring the Wigner function of the entangled modes, one can do it. Question: can one characterize the entanglement from this measurement just by looking at a few points? And finally, taming the coherence, of course, is a big challenge in this field. Conclusions: cavity QED allows a detailed study of the coherence. The Wigner function of a field in a cavity can be directly measured and allows monitoring the decoherence process in real time, okay? Because it's a fast measuring process. And we have new proposals for investigation of non-local fields in a localization and configuration space, distillation, and measurement of supplanck structures. Okay. Thank you.
Fritz.
Point where you do it is actually not a very macroscopic thing. Any number of codons in the coherent state for a single digit number.
Yes.
Has there been progress?
No, I mean, it has been, no, I mean, there is some progress. Now they're rebuilding the experiment, and hopefully soon there will be some progress on that. Okay, in other words, it's not that the Q of the cavity will increase, not necessarily so. It may increase, but not necessarily so. But there was some problem with thermal photons in the cavity, which spoiled the contrast of these measurements. Okay, so because of this microwave source, thermal photons are being injected into the cavity also, and they're taking care of that. So maybe experiments with better definition could be done. And of course, I think the most beautiful experiment would be to see those fringes actually, but that's quite a challenge actually.
Yeah. One last question.
At the beginning of your talk, you distinguished between super selection rules and decoherence.
Yes.
What do you think of various attempts of people to understand superselection in terms of
decoherence itself? Yes, okay. So you see, first let me make this remark. You know, these people mentioned that you don't have non-local observables available, so that's why you cannot measure the interference, even if the coherence is there. Now, these experiments show that it's not true. I mean, you have these two cavities, for instance, and you do have a non-local observable, which is this atom which goes through the two cavities and is sensitive to the coherence between the two fields. Okay, so we can actually have non-local observables, and these experiments are based on them actually. Okay, so that's one thing. So you really there are two different things. You get the coherence in this case very clearly because of entanglement with the environment. And there, I think that the selection rule, which is important, is this Ein selection, environment-induced selection rule, that in the sense that you see that here, the coherent states, they play a privileged role. Okay? They're quite resistant to the action of the environment. However, superpositions of them decay very fast, and the coherence decays very fast. So that's also a probing of the Ein selection rule.
Such as the ability to create superposition of charge states.
Yeah, okay, so that's, but of course that's not what is being probed here, okay? And yeah, so that's of course, that still stands. And what's being probed here is this superselection rule as far as localization goes. Okay. Yes. Okay. So that's related actually to Fritz's question. See, in the experiment which was done, the published result, I think, was with an average photon number of perhaps 4, something like that, but they went up to 10, okay? 10 photons, it's okay. In principle, you could think that, you know, in principle, it's not just principle from a theoretician point of view. I mean, that's, you know, it seems like they could go perhaps to 20, 15, 20, but not much more than that. And what are the problems? Well, first, there is this, you know, the coherence time, of course, gets faster and faster, right? And you do have some measuring time, which is related to the interaction time between the atom and the field you are probing, right? And you want the decoherence time to be larger than this time, okay? So that's really a limitation, okay? So unless, of course, you could produce some very large phase shifts, even for a small interaction time, but one doesn't know how to do that. So I think that one of the main limitations is just this interaction time, which does not allow the coherence times, which are too small. I mean, if they are too small, we will not be able to measure them. Even with? Yes, right. Yeah, they are. They are the orthogonal states, right. Yes. I mean, I think that you know, that at least that was useful to verify, say, a law, which is a decoherence law. And in fact, with that experiment, it was possible to show that indeed the coherence time is inversely proportional to the distance between the two states, and that was very clearly shown.
Okay, so let's thank Luis once again. Okay. And